Right, well, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Ignite. And for many of you, this is going to be the first of many exam prep sessions hopefully you're going to take a look at. This is the exam prep session for the 7240 exam.
Which 7740.
7240, not the Windows 2001. I keep making that mistake. Installation, storage, and compute with Windows Server 2016. Okay. My name is Chris Rhodes. I work for a company called IT Masterclasses. We're a training company provider. I'm a Windows MVP, but more importantly, I'm a Microsoft certified trainer. So I teach Windows technologies, Windows Server, Windows Client. I've been doing that for about 20 years.
And I am Joe Lurie. I'm from the Boston area. Some of you will recognize my accent. Some of you will go Red Sox and go Patriots, and some of you will boo Red Sox and boo Patriots, and I'm good with either one of those. I'm also an MCT, and I work for a small company called Microsoft, where I'm a consultant in their MCS division. And I do most projects on server upgrades, on client upgrades, system center, stuff like that, EMS.
Okay. So we're excited to talk about this today. This is a brand new technology and also a brand new exam that's not even actually out yet as of today, but it's imminent. So I'm keen to see so many of you. We've literally got a packed house here, so I'm really keen to see so many of you want to get certified already on this. That's really good signals for us. We're going to talk about what's on the exam. We're going to try and give you some hints and tips. We're going to walk through what's covered on the exam. We've got 75 minutes, so we can't tell you everything there is. We're going to go deep dive on some areas. We're going to go fast on others. But you guys get to have copies of these decks for later consumption. So you don't need to take photographs. You don't need to write notes. You get these to download after the session as well. So what we're going to do is we're going to walk through the main six areas, which are all about Windows installation and compute environments. We're going to look at storage solutions, Hyper-V, containers, high availability, and monitoring. And we've spelled those out here for you to display really the different percentage breakdowns that are weighted on the exams. So as you can see, some areas are more important from a percentage marks point of view for your exam than others. So when you're coming to do study and revision, we want you to bear that in mind. Spend the time wisely, spend it accurately that you're developing your knowledge, but in a wise manner. So don't spend too long on certain areas. Of course, unless they're new to you. And there's lots of new areas, isn't there? So we're going to start off with the installation, and Joe's going to walk you through that one.
Thank you. All right, so we're talking about installing Server 2016. How many of you, and you can raise your hands, have installed recently, like Server 2012 R2 or Server 2008? So most of the room. Surprisingly, yeah, pretty much all of the room. And some people haven't done a server install since Server 2003 because the companies are still running 2003 and are in the process of migrating now. So, you laugh, but again, I work for Microsoft Consulting Services and I do a lot of server upgrade projects. So yes, you can laugh because it's funny that it happens. Matter of fact, I'm going to digress for a second. My last Server 2003 project ended in June 30th was my last day. And in May, I was talking to one of the IT guys, and they said, well, we set this up a year ago because we never considered the end of Server 2003 a year ago. That was May 2016. They never considered the end of life of Server 2003 until we came in. And we were actually in the middle of the project at the time as well. Anyway, so yeah, when we talk about installing, we have a lot of these types of slides. And as Chris was saying, we have 75 minutes. So these slides is just here to introduce you to the next section. I'm just going to jump right over this. But this section is installation requirements. It's installing Server 2016 and the new Nano server and stuff like that. So first of all, we have several editions that can be installed. We have Essentials, which used to be called Small Business Server back in the day. It's still the same type of thing. It's really meant for a smaller company. You might get something on the exam where it says you're an administrator for a small company looking to upgrade to Server 2016, and you have these requirements. Standard Edition, now one thing about Standard Edition that you should note, people know like with Data Center Edition, you get unlimited VM licenses with Data Center Edition. With Standard Edition, you get two VM licenses. Now the caveat on that is you get two licenses, but only if the host is only running those two VMs. If that host is doing anything like DNS or any other service, you actually only get one VM license. Again, that's something to note as well. There is the Hyper-V server, which is just what it sounds like. It's meant for Hyper-V. And Storage Server in Workgroup and Standard Edition. Workgroup Edition, not unlike Essentials, is really good for 50 users in a workgroup. And Standard Edition really meant for your enterprises. Now, as we go to install, the hardware requirements are, you'll see they're very minimal. First of all, it is 64-bit. You can install with as little as 512 mega RAM, which I hope none of you do outside of your lab or your Hyper-V or your Azure environments, but you can. But note, we actually have a note there that setup's going to fail if you have only 512 mega RAM. Setup will fail, right? So you can install it with a gig of RAM and then cut it back down to 512 mega RAM. Setup will fail with only 512 mega RAM. And it's mostly because of page files and stuff like that. So just keep that stuff in mind. Also, you want to have a TPM. You want to do UEFI on the BIOS. There's other requirements, but hardware related. Again, a normal 1.4 gig processor and a 64-bit architecture only, 32 gig hard drive. Now, also with the hard drive, if you're doing a network-based installation, you'll need a little more hard drive space to store it. But again, 32 gigs is fairly small for a server. You'll see we have a picture here of what setup actually looks like. Now, what you see is it says Server 2016 standard and then desktop experience in parentheses. You'll notice the default is core. That's what we used to call server core, which still do kind of call server core. But the default installation, if you just run setup, next, you're going to end up with a core installation. Now, core is not nano. It's a little beefier than nano, and it's not desktop experience, which used to be called with GUI, server with GUI. It's somewhere in between, right? It's a command line interface. So the default is that you get server core, but of course you can install standard edition, data center edition with the desktop or as core. Just have to select that during the setup if you're running the manual setup. Other things, by the way, like nano server, we're going to get to that in a second, but that can be installed, just not through setup. You still can install nano server. Right, and here it is. So what is nano server? Now, nano server, how many of you have actually heard of nano server? As I've said it five times already. All right, so again, most of the room is that why you're all here? You all want to know about nano server? Because honestly, as Chris was saying, we can give you tips and tricks to get through the exam, but we can't actually teach you all the ins and outs of Server 2016. But nano server, it's a cool new server feature, if you will. It's a very small footprint. It has, it's even smaller than server core. There's different management tools. For example, there's no task manager. There's no like file explorer. You can manage it with server manager connecting to it. Now, nano server is meant, I thought I actually did that, is meant for, it's headless, 64-bit. We call it a deployment option, but again, it can't be run through setup. It is really based on, you can read there, the Cloud Fabric infrastructure. It's VMs is why we're going to really run it to host our VM infrastructure. We also have, I was going to say, I know I'm hitting this button. It's extended server core. Actually, not even extended server core. It's minimal server core. Roles and features can be installed with like DISM commands. It's headless. You're not going to remote into it and install those roles and features. Standalone packages, full driver support. Again, that all lives outside of the operating system.
Yeah, and that's a good point to note because they need to know about how do you get these extras on board because it's so small, it doesn't come with much. You have to go out and get stuff to put on it. So we'll talk to that in a second.
The question is, can you use PowerShell? So PowerShell is one of the commands you can use to install the packages. And I think we have that coming up here in a second as well. So again, you can install options. So to install server core, you can install it as your physical host. You can also nano server. You can install it as a physical host to host your VMs. You can also install it inside of a VM. We have a slide coming up where they do that. And you can see the different roles that are supported as of today, which is whatever today is, September something, 2016. As of today, the roles supported Hyper-V, DNS server, failover clustering, web services. These are some of your supported roles.
But we don't have things like Active Directory on here, and it's a small list of support.
Active Directory not supported.
No.
Not Active Directory. But yes, DNS. So keep that in mind, too, because for most of our technology lives, we were told, or at least since 2000, you want to have your DNS server, Active Directory integrated. In the case of nano server, DNS is supported, but Active Directory is not supported. So they would actually be separate in that case. So we're talking about installing. Yes, you can install it. Nano server, did I say server core again a minute ago? Anytime I say server core from now to the end of this session, I'm referring to Nano Server, not Server Core. So you need to do that kind of resolution on your own, because I just keep doing it by mistake. Again, it cannot be selected during setup. It actually, Nano Server, I did it right, isn't it's its own directory on the installation media. And you install it, let's go back to the install it. Adding packages, as I said, we have DISM commands. We had the slides coming up. Add package, and whether you want the Hyper-V role again or the web services role, it's all part of the DISM commands here. Now, on the exam, the exams like to do stuff with command lines. How many of you have taken an exam in the last 12 months? All right, only about a quarter of the room have taken an exam in the last 12 months. So the exams like to do, there's different types of exam questions now than there were 3 years ago. And a lot of the exam questions might be a DISM command like this, where you have a list of commands on the right they have to drag into a section on the left. So make sure you understand DISM, add package, package path, because it's entirely possible that you'll get questions, how do you install whatever role, the Hyper-V role on a Nano server. You're the administrator for Contoso, you need to install the, you know, you have a Nano server installation, you need to install the Hyper-V role. Which DISM command will you do? Either they'll all be listed out, or you'll have to drag pieces of it into the correct statement on the right-hand side.
So it's good to know also why you got that up about packages and the names of these packages, and also where to get them, which I think we got coming up, haven't we?
Yeah, I think we do. So it's a package repository. So today's Nano server, and again, today is, and I don't know why I don't know the date. It's September something, 2016. So today's Nano server, the roles and features are available in a package repository on the media. That wasn't true a month ago. So it is true today going forward. It's available on the on a package repository on the media. And as we were just saying, yes, you can use PowerShell to install it. We're showing you DISM commands for packages, but you can also use install package provider, Nano server package, as one of your PowerShell commands. And I'm going to give the same caveat that it's entirely possible that you may get a question like that on the exam where they're asking you how to install a package on Nano server. This exam, as we said, Nano server today is different than Nano server was a month ago, but the exam was written with that in mind. So when the exam goes live next week is the, right now, the unofficial date that it's going live. When it does go live, I would expect to see some of today's TP5 and above Nano or RTM Nano questions. All right, so we have here the next section, leaving Nano, is converting a WIM file to a VHD file. Why do we need to convert a WIM to a VHD file? No, why? How? Not how. Why do we need to? Can we live with a WIM file? Yeah, this is what I'm doing for VM deployment. So on your Windows 10, on your server 2016, mount the ISO. And we have here, assuming the drive letter is D, you run this command, copy D nano server to C nano server. But so what we're talking about, we want to install Nano in a VM on Hyper-V. So you create the VHD file, and then, and I'm not going to read this to you, but change to the Nano server and then convert Windows image.ps1. And here's the basically what it is, source path, and the VHD format edition and whatnot. Do you have anything?
No, so I was going to say, it's just a nice fast way of getting Nano onto a VM, basically.
Yep.
So know about the conversion.
Now, we have here a picture of an unattended answer file. And I don't know how clear it is, but you can see it's highlighted. Insert name here. That's going to be the name of your Nano server. Insert IP address here. Insert admin password here. So you can customize your Nano installation with this. So we're talking about convert it to the VHD, customize your installation, set the computer names. We have a couple of other things that you can set up, domain join, which you can also do djoin.exe to join a domain. But so domain join, installing additional agents and tools. Again, if you wanted to install IIS as an example, role features. And we're just going to keep going past that. All right, we have a nice, our helper that helped us with this one slide loves animations. All right, so creating and installing Nano server. We're starting off with, we've copied it over. We're in the C:MS directory. All right, so we're running the PowerShell command. Looking for the requested Windows image, image one selected, creating sparse disk, attaching VHD, continuing on until we get.
I know. Yeah, and the picture's just showing you like how small this is, right?
Right.
400 megabytes.
One,
is a kind of standard size for a nano image. So it's pretty small, like a tenth the size of your normal Windows Server image. So this is all about, you know, data center density. We were talking about this earlier, weren't we? About getting more compute power out of less space.
Absolutely. And here's just an example of what we find here in the nano server directory. We go to install, we go to log into nano server, and that's all we get here. All right, so we're talking about a small footprint. I said earlier there's no task manager. Like something as basic as task manager is not included in nano server. So we can remotely manage nano server, and as Chris explained, you're going to get this slide at the end of the week. So I'm certainly not going to read these 50 bullet points to you, but different ways that you can manage it. You can use PowerShell and just do ps session computer name. You can go to Server Manager and connect to your nano server. You can use other, you know, .NET tools or custom tools, Docker support. There's PowerShell and remote file transfer. So there's still a lot of ways to remotely manage your nano server, even though you're not going to remotely log in, or you're not going to physically log in and do a lot of the stuff that you're used to doing with your server operating systems. Keeping in mind, because it's not a GUI and it is a tiny little footprint, most of your administration will be done remotely. All right. Yep, go ahead.
Do we need to apply Windows updates to these servers?
So the question is, do we need to apply Windows updates to the servers?
Yeah, but you're not going to have anywhere near as many. So,
and not only that, but right now the documentation says Nano Server only needs to be rebooted twice a year. I mean, that's how like it's small. It's not going to be overloaded, and that's the recommendation right now is twice a year. So you won't have nearly as many patches if you have them at all.
It's a living, breathing Windows system, but it's not going to need as many patches, partly because it's so small, but partly the design is such that it should not need so much doing to it because it's a small lockdown environment anyway, and it's just a host platform for running other stuff on top.
Obviously, the VMs running within Hyper-V, you know, they'll be patched like your normal servers are being patched. That's a good question. All right, so we'll talk about PowerShell. PowerShell, basically, is 5.0. It's refactored to run on the .NET runtimes, the core language runtime, full language compatibility, invoke command, as I just said, do a PS session, new PS session, dash computer name to manage it, or enter PS session, and supports all the new commandlets as well.
But it supports Nano too, right?
Yep. Cool. So that's why I pause here. So it supports commandlets right now. Today we have a limited set of commandlets available for Nano. But there's always growing. This is a management tool that's hosted in Azure. Now, because Nano is so limited on what it has available to it, and as we said, there's no task manager, there's no event viewer, there's a lot of things that are, you know, and I'm going to air quote, missing from Nano Server. They're not missing. They're just excluded from Nano Server. So administering it, we talked about through PowerShell, we talked about through, again, Server Manager. This is a dashboard that's hosted on Azure. It's totally web-based and includes a replacement for these tools in one dashboard. You can connect to your Nano server and you can run a event viewer, device manager, sconfig as needed from the Azure dashboard. And this is just called a server management tools, and you can literally do a Bing search for server management tools and this will show up as one of your first hits.
It's pretty cool. You get access to things like PowerShell from in there as well. You need to install a gateway here to connect it up to your enterprise.
That's a good point. Thank you.
This is cloud-based, so you're going to look at it through a web-based portal, but it's going to be able to connect back to your systems running on-premises, whether those are regular servers, nano servers, core, whatever. All right? So that's where that comes from.
I think we have enough, yeah. Yep, there we go. You want to talk?
Yeah, why not? Why not? Yeah, go ahead. So the next section here we're going to look at is creating, managing and maintaining images for deployment. And so we're thinking here more about deploying servers, probably Windows servers, but we'll talk about some others as well. And one of the first things we're going to talk about here is virtualization. We've got probably most people in this room doing virtualization of servers to some extent, but we kind of want you to go further with that. And we're going to talk about nested virtualization later. But for now, we want to talk about how do we go from physical servers, how do we get those into virtual machines, not just Windows servers as well. And so one of the tools that we want to just quickly mention here is the MAP toolkit. If you haven't tried this before, it's a great tool for analyzing your network and finding good candidates for virtualization. So this is great for looking at a physical estate and saying, hey, look, you've got some servers here. Why aren't you virtualizing those? Those are only running at 20% utilization. You could virtualize several of those on the same host and condense your data center. Run it on some virtual machines. And like we were saying here, we've got much smaller footprints now to run virtualization on, courtesy of NanoServer especially. So you've got an even better value for money out of virtualizing. So if you went through and looked at this a couple of years ago, it's almost worth revisiting this to see how does that compute work out now, factoring in the technology changes we've just been talking about.
How many of you here have used the MAP toolkit for your... All right, again, it's about half of the room.
That's good.
So when you use the MAP toolkit, one of the discoveries you can do is all the SQL servers, then it has all the databases installed on that, so you can see really the power that that server is going to need. And again, as Chris was saying, if that's a good candidate for virtualization. You also see if you happen to be using VMware, you connect to the it connects to the VMware host, and it can actually read all the guests on the VMware. So it's come a long way from back in the days when it first came out.
Yeah, and talking about things that have changed and come a long way as well, there's now also native support for non-Microsoft operating systems. And when I say support, it doesn't just mean Microsoft will allow you to do it, but they'll actually support you. Hold your hand and help you get this working. Okay, so the support guys are all tasked up, so they know how these things work. So we've got, we don't have a full list here, but there is a full list, and we've pointed out for you, about how to add support for those, how to install those. There are nuances for each of those operating systems, but essentially we've got support for Linux, FreeBSD, so we can run those workloads here as well. So we're trying to basically present the compute platform and then let you choose what you want to put on top of that, which if you ever work with Azure, I do a lot of work with Azure, you know that's how that works too, and so they're trying to echo that down on the on-premises environment as well.
So one of the things that you should know is that you do need the Linux integration services, the FreeBSD, which the BE integration services, so BIS and LIS, and those are already installed on the Linux OS for the newer versions. It's already installed on the FreeBSD OS for the newer versions. For older versions, you can always download them from their sites where you got the OS from.
Okay. Something I talk to a lot of customers about is about images. A lot of folks make images. Yeah, have a question? Okay, so the question is, why is the kernel support a little bit lagged?
Yes, because there are 3 months, 4 months, and...
3 or 4 months. Well, one of the reasons is they have to train the folks up so that they can support that. Just because a new kernel is available generally on the open source market doesn't necessarily mean that Microsoft are happy to support it, because they have to train their guys up ready for that as well. So it's not necessarily a technology thing. It's more about ensuring that customers are able to be fully supported and not just say, hey, it's out, we can go with it. We'll actually hold your hand. If you phone up for support, we'll help you. So there's a time lag to get people physically trained on that, mostly.
Watch.
Yep, that's okay. Okay, something that's kind of close to my heart, because I talk to customers about this on a week-to-week basis, is images. A lot of you here, who's created a server image for deployment? Maybe a WIM file, and you're reissuing that. So one of the problems that companies face with that is that they find that over time that image goes stale. There are going to be updates. There are going to be changes you want to make to that. So one of the things that you do need to know for the test is, how do I keep these current? We've got tools in things like System Center Virtual Machine Manager for doing that, but also natively, there's tools like, you've mentioned DISM, haven't you, about ensuring that computers are kept up to date. So if you're not familiar with DISM, it's come up once already, get into that, find out how do you do that, how do you apply an update offline, how do I apply it to my image so that when I come and deploy my server, it's ready to go, it's ready to hit the ground running, and we don't need to spend an hour patching that to get it up to production readiness. Okay, so this can be done offline on a month-to-month basis, so you're always deploying fresh machines.
And one thing you should know also is the difference between offline and online imaging, and when I would use online imaging, because most people are like, why would I use online imaging or online servicing? And I would use that because maybe I have to add an application to my image. And offline servicing may or may not allow that application to install. If it's a .exe or .msi, it won't, but other .whatevers might. So you might use online servicing to install something like that, or if the what you're installing requires a running service, .NET framework, it has to be running while we're updating this, you would have to do an online servicing, not an offline servicing.
Yeah, that's a good point. So you kind of need to know the distinction between when can I do an offline, when can I do an online, where do I have to go online. Okay, cool. Right, so we've kind of almost hit the end of the first section. Let's see if you were paying attention. We have a practice question. Let's see what you get. You plan to install a server that runs NanoServer. You need to ensure that the server can run virtual machines. Which PowerShell command should you run? Oh, already, I haven't even read that. So, all right, okay, well, that seems to be the consensus. So I was going to read out the answers, but everyone seems to have jumped straight to D. D is the correct answer. It's a compute, yes. Yeah, you might expect the package that we install to NanoServer be called something like Hyper-V, but it's not. It's part of the compute platform, and in fact, this whole section was called compute. But yeah, on Nano, it's called compute, and that gives you the hypervisor support in Nano. Okay. Now, this is what we talked about before. Get familiar with these packages. Why? Because you're going to have to install them, whether it's through DISM, whether it's through PowerShell. You have to install support manually. It's not just going to come on board. You can't just use Server Manager and add roles. It doesn't work like that on Nano. You have to do the command line. You have to add these in. So well done, those who got that. Good for you. If not, there's a link at the bottom to find out more about these packages and how to do that.
And so we just have some tips for you for the end of this section. Nano Server. Again, most of you came in looking for Nano Server, and that's our tip number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. So Nano Server, installing it, maintaining it, managing it. So become familiar with that. It can be installed in your VMs right on your desktop running Windows 10, Hyper-V. When you go to install, we have a setup.exe includes server core, which is a default. Again, it doesn't say core any longer, and it doesn't say with GUI any longer. It simply says Server 2016 standard, Server 2016 standard desktop experience, and data center desktop experience. So again, so just keep that in mind. Managing server core, managing Nano server, know the difference when I would use one over the other one, bigger footprints, easier to... Server core might be easier to manage than Nano. Nano is a more, you know, smaller footprint, so there's pluses and minuses to both. I mentioned djoin.exe to join a domain. Again, be familiar with some of those commands and the map toolkit. Using map toolkit, we can run discovery, hardware inventories, database inventories, website inventories, stuff like that. Server virtualization using Hyper-V, Azure, map toolkit can help you find out what's on your network.
Okay, so let's move on to section number 2, which is implementing storage solutions. So quite a wide area of stuff here to look at in this section. We're going to deep dive onto some of these in a second. But everything from file systems to storage pools, kind of everything in between. And also a whole bunch of new features that might likely catch some of you out if you haven't actually tried these and looked at them yourselves as well. So we'll talk about those along the way. So some of these slides we're going to burn through pretty quick because it's not necessarily new technology, but we just wanted to have these slides here for you guys to see. Know about things like partition tables. When do I use MBR? When do I use GPT? And essentially, nothing much new to talk about here, but we just wanted to give you the facts and figures. So 2 terabytes is kind of our main boundary difference between when I'd use one over the other. Okay. File systems. There's a bigger emphasis nowadays on REFS. In fact, I think it's a default, isn't it, when you come in format a volume? It's a default now in 2016 to format a file system that way. Know the pros and cons of each of these. It's still perfectly viable to use FAT or FAT32 sometimes. The bulk of the time you're not going to be, but you've got to know when that's appropriate. But more importantly, know what's the difference between NTFS and REFS. They're designed to be broadly similar, but REFS is a newer thing. It's been tweaked again in 2016. It was new for 2012, you might remember, but it's had some tweaks done to it here in 2012 as well. But it gives us basically support for better error correction, better uptime, I suppose you could say, if it to be fair, so that we're not doing things like check disk after a reboot. You ever had that pain before? So if you want to avoid those things, go for REFS, but also know the drawbacks. There's certain things that are not supported there, like EFS, I think, from memory, whereas NTFS can do that. But if you want to set file permissions, either of them can do that. Okay, so do some checks. Virtual hard disks. You know, I'm surprised, actually, even though this is a technology that has been around for a while, not many people truly know this. Virtual hard disks are not just used for Hyper-V. That might be your first thought, but actually we can do boot to VHD, we've discussed previously. We can also mount them natively. We can use them in storage spaces. We can use them for iSCSI storage. They're quite versatile. And the great thing I like about these is they are just portable files at the end of the day. You can move them around. Know about the formats. VHD's been around a little while. VHDX, a little bit newer. VHDX has some benefits, bigger size. We can go greater than 2 terabytes in size on those. But we can also share them. I do a lot of work with virtual machines, and if you're doing things like clustering with virtual machines, you can actually have shared VHDX files that you can point several guest machines to so that you can form clusters using shared VHDX for storage. For certain roles, that's pretty useful to do. So know about how we establish those. Okay. Also know about how to do this. I've put here at the bottom here a few different tips about tools that you might want to use to do that. Know the limitations and benefits of each. Disk management's okay. Some of you might have exposure to that from your Server 2003 days, but we don't really have much new stuff in there. In fact, nothing new. You should be using things like Server Manager, PowerShell, maybe disk part occasionally. So it's a case of knowing what's best in each case. Okay, I think I just talked about that.
Yep.
Let's move on. So for example, I put here a little tip, you know, where would you create a storage space? Which of those tools might you use to do that? Certainly not disk management. Even though that might be something you're familiar with, that's not the right answer. It's going to be PowerShell or it's going to be a server manager. Okay, permissions. This is a bread and butter thing here. You need to know this thoroughly. And again, I find that many people don't quite know this. They think they know it, but they don't. So know about things like permissions, deny permissions, going into what were we looking at the other day, effective permissions.
Effective permissions.
Being able to detail who's got access to something that way.
And this hasn't really changed at all since
it hasn't, but
15
it,
years.
It catches right? people
it
out.
It catches a lot of people. They still test on it on the exams because people still are being, you know, they don't know the effective permissions. When they assign someone to multiple groups, and multiple groups have different permissions. So make sure you understand how NTFS permissions work.
Yeah, it's an old favorite. Okay, server storage. Now, some of the stuff on here has changed. There's new features you might recognize on the slide here that have come up on 2016 for new. So let's talk about some of the storage you got. Something I was discussing yesterday in our Windows 10 sessions was storage pools. Storage pools is really software-defined storage. And Microsoft are very keen on having you guys learn about this because it gives you options to possibly make your storage solutions cheaper and to allow you to use commodity storage and join things together. So know about how to create a storage pool. What is a storage pool? What's a primordial storage pool? What are these different things I can build with my pool? Know about thin provisioning, fixed provisioning. You know, so you can actually present space to applications that's perhaps larger than you've actually got as physical space, and then add more storage to that later, which is very useful for applications that constantly consume more and more space. You don't want to move their files down the road when they run out of space on a certain drive letter. We can just keep adding space to that drive letter in effect as time goes on by adding more physical storage space underneath. So know about the different kinds of options you've got. We've got some examples of that here on the disk layouts. So when you create a pool, you can create things like simple disk layouts, parity layouts, mirrors, okay? And there's different requirements in each case. So you can have a mirror, for example, that's got just two disks, and that will give you some resilience. You know, what you used to call RAID 1, right? We don't call it RAID 1 on screen, but that's what it's basically doing. You've got two disks together there in your pool being taken up to present that storage. But that's okay if you want to protect against one disk failure. What if you want to go and protect against two disk failures? Then we need slightly more disks. So you've got to know the ins and outs of this. And a really good tip from me here is go and make some virtual hard disks. Attach them to a virtual machine, and that will present as many disks as you want to present to that server. And then you can go and play with all of this stuff without it costing you any money, without having to worry about plugging disks in. Do it all in a virtual machine. You get to play with all that, experiment with it. You can also simulate disk failure by disabling some of those virtual hard disks at the Hyper-V level and experiment with how to fix that. So that's what I would recommend when you're studying this.
Yep, go ahead.
How do you, on the previous slide, it said three disks for one disk failure, seven disks for two disk failure. What is the equation for that, is it?
What is the equation? Okay, so the question is, what for the parity disk layouts?
Exactly. So if I went up to like 16 disks, how many parity do I get?
Oh, okay, if I went up to 60 disks. So these we've quoted here the minimums. What's the algorithm behind that? You're putting me on the spot. I have no idea.
RAID 6 is like an N plus.
No, okay, I see what you're saying.
On the plus side, you won't get tested on that. On a downside, we actually don't know that answer.
I don't know. Because it's hidden behind the pool. The pool
right.
takes care of this.
Right.
The pool recalculates. If you add another disk to the pool and you add it into that, it recalculates all of that for you. So honestly, we don't know because we don't see it. It's completely invisible to us. And it will recalculate that for you. Likewise, when you take disks away, if one has failed and it has to recalibrate, it just does that, right? So that's great. I used to remember doing this on the physical RAID controller and having to work all of that out. Now it's just add it in, let it recalibrate, done. But yeah, kind of know the facts and figures here, guys. iSCSI, I use this quite a lot in training courses and also for customers. iSCSI, we've got support both for the consumption of iSCSI resources by the iSCSI initiator. So you might configure that on a Windows server to connect to iSCSI storage you have on your network. So make sure you've been through the iSCSI initiator and you've connected it to something before. But also at the other end of that, an iSCSI target. And if you haven't done much work with iSCSI, it's basically shared storage over TCP/IP. So it allows you to set up, for example, one computer as a storage server running the iSCSI target, have another server connect over a regular Ethernet connection to that to be able to access the storage that's being presented there. And the drives appear almost as if they're local drives on the computer running the initiator. So we can use that for things like clustering. We can use it for things like Hyper-V. It's fairly simple to set this up purely through software. Some of you might be attaching that to physical iSCSI devices on the network as well. But if you haven't had exposure to the physical side of it, all of this can be done through software. So you'll just need a couple of test virtual machines to experiment with this, build the initiator in one, build the target in the other, and have them join up over the network to one another. Storage replica. I really love this feature. This is new for 2016, and I'm sure many of you will leverage this in years to come as we go through. Storage replica allows you to have a few different scenarios catered for, but essentially, as the name suggests, to replicate storage. So it's a software-based storage replication technology. Some of you here may have paid thousands and thousands of dollars over the years for, you know, hardware systems that do this for you, and I'm not saying they're no good or anything, but they do cost money. This is all in box. So we can use the software-based, either synchronous or asynchronous replication of data between servers, let's say in the same data center, or even servers between two different data centers. Does that sound interesting? Okay, some of you thinking, yes, sir? Oh, good question. What would be the difference between using this and DFS? Well, DFS is a specific use case. That's for shared folders only. This is for any storage. Anything at all. Your application or your service sits on top of that. This broadens out, therefore, what you can do with it. It's just generic, if you will, replication. So you're talking about FileShare specifically. This is just opening that. It's not the same as DFS, but conceptually, I can see where you're coming from. It's similar, but it's now broadening it out. Yep. Does it require a resilient file system? I can't remember.
I don't think it does.
Does it work on NTFS and RFS?
I thought it worked on NTFS also.
I think it's both, but it's certainly not FAT. Yes, sir? Exactly. So you can do synchronous. I don't have it on the slide here, but it will do synchronous or asynchronous. So it depends on your application as to how it wants to do that. I don't think I have a link on it, but have a look on TechNet because there's a really good article that explains it like this deep. We don't have all day for this. We could spend a whole hour on this. Right, I'll take any other questions on that one at the end because we're going to move on. Data deduplication. This is a storage technology that was introduced into Server 2012. Again, it's been revamped a little bit here. This is quite a fantastic feature that allows you to do analysis of blocks on the hard drive and to basically single instance those. It's not installed by default, so what do you need to know for the test? Well, you need to know things like, how do I configure this? How do I install support for this? How does it actually work on my system here? So one of the first things you need to do is add support. Okay, you can do it through Server Manager. I'm just doing it here through PowerShell with Add Windows feature, because it's quicker that way, I guess. But also know about the tool called DDP Eval. That tool will analyze your volume and say, hey, this is going to give you like only 1% difference, don't bother. Or this is going to give you 70% difference, definitely do this. So the analysis can be done before you commit to actually running it. And once you do that, you do it per volume in Server Manager, or you can do it through, again, PowerShell for this. It'll always work against files of a certain age or over. So it won't work on the very freshest files because they're likely to be changing. Users may have the files open. So it's usually going to work on data that's a couple of days old. I think 3 days is the default. So it can really start to grab that data that's kind of committed on the drive and isn't being edited too much. Yes, sir, in the yellow. Will it work with NTFS and RFS? Yeah. Yep. All right, so practice question. Let's see what you guys know.
You plan to create a storage pool in Server 2016 that will provide storage for an app named App1. You need to ensure App1 can still function. I think we just actually talked about this. If the server suffers two disk failures, how should you prepare the virtual disk for App1? A simple storage layout with 7 physical disks, a mirror layout with 5, a parity layout with 5, or a parity layout with 4?
You can't go for answers that aren't on here.
I think we just talked about that.
We just talked about that? Okay. So
wait. If two disks fail.
Yeah, a mirror with 5, actually.
A mirror with five.
Yep. If you wanted to do parity, you would need 7. That wasn't a choice. But you can do it with parity with 5.
So remember, the simple storage with 7 is the trick. Because you all thought of 7, right? 7 if 2 disks fail. But simple storage doesn't have any parity.
Okay. Everyone get that, hopefully?
That's the trick. And that's why you have to read everything. And they're all, they're not designed to trick you. They're not designed to test your reading comprehension, but they do want to make sure you follow all the, requirements.
It should say a three-way mirror. Well, it's still a parity. It's the second question in the wizard. You're splitting hairs. Next.
And by the way, that's not a real question. These are questions that we made up when we created the decks.
Yeah, we just made this up. Honestly, though, back to your question, the stuff about two-way, three-way is kind of a secondary question. When you actually come to see the wizard, I'm visualizing it in my mind now, it's actually 3 choices.
Right.
Is it simple? Is it parity? What was the other one? Whatever the other one's called. But it's actually a wizard that says which one is of these 3. There's only 3 choices on that. And then depending on what you select on that one, then goes on to the second thing. So I'm right, carry on. Right, Hyper-V. Chris is always right. Okay, next up, Hyper-V. Hey. So we're gonna talk about Hyper-V here. Some good stuff to talk about. Hardware-wise, well, some interesting stuff happening with Hyper-V. Some of this isn't new, some is. So what do we need to get Hyper-V working? We do need a physical computer that has 64-bit support. Well, that's generic for 2016 anyway. They're all gonna have that. But we need SLAT support specifically for the processor. We also need virtualization support activated, if it's not already, via your BIOS or your UFI. Okay, so that can be a stumbling block if it's not actually turned on. And chipsets to support this. So we have 2 here, Intel VT, AMD V. Finally, data execution prevention enabled. So that's kind of your shopping list of features on your hardware side that you need to have enabled before you can even think about installing the ROL, otherwise it just won't install. You can run system info to check whether that's validated or not from a command prompt, and that will tell you whether it's good enough to run Hyper-V. What's kind of interesting here is optional support. If you want to do some of the more advanced stuff, TPMs are required, and Joe talked about that at the start. Yep. You don't need to have a TPM, but it's quite useful if you want to combine some of the features like shielded VMs down the road later on. Software-wise, one of the great things now is you can run this on all of the editions we've talked about. So GUI mode, server with desktop experience, right? Server core, and also Nano Server. So that's quite attractive, I think, for some people here. In terms of guest support, we already talked about those before, including the Linux and Windows as well.
And we put their Linux FreeBSD, but in the link in the earlier slide, there's a whole slew of operating systems, Linux-related, like Red Hat, whatever, Linux OSs, that are supported.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of distros. We didn't have space on the slides. Management. So you've got to know how to manage this. Hyper-V Manager is probably your first go-to tool to manage this, but don't just confine yourself to that. You need to know also where things like PowerShell come into play. Also, if I want to manage this remotely, I'm running, say, a Nano server. How am I going to do that? Well, I'm probably going to use Hyper-V Manager, but I'm going to do that remotely, right? I'm not going to run it on the actual host itself because I can't. Know also about a new feature called PowerShell Direct. PowerShell Direct is kind of interesting because this is about giving access to manage, let's say, virtual machines when you can't contact the host directly. It allows you to kind of map through the PowerShell and to kind of almost bypass a layer where you wouldn't normally have access to that host to manipulate things. Look it up. It's pretty interesting, but it could be a value here for folks who work in security, want to lock things down. It's not a way to bypass it. In fact, it's a way to work alongside higher security, but still give you access to manage things. Okay, it's called PowerShell Direct. It's a new feature. One thing I think we're going to hear about quite a lot in months to come is nested virtualization. Finally, hey, that's a cheer, right? Yay. So we can run Hyper-V on Hyper-V. How's that sound?
You don't care?
Oh, hard audience,
we got people,
man.
For those
hard
of you that audience. Can't see the room, people are shaking their head. They don't care about nested virtualization.
That was, like that was
running
a collective.
Running Hyper-V inside of a Hyper-V guest.
That's pretty cool.
That's cool. I mean, even if it's just for your lab or your dev environments, that's actually it's a pretty cool feature.
Mm-hmm. So this works across all the Windows Server installs that we've talked about. What do you need for this then? So you're going to need, obviously, 2016 running Hyper-V. As the first layer at the bottom. You also need at the hardware underneath that, it's a kind of a subset of the requirements that we talked about before. At this time, it has to be an Intel processor underneath that, And also it has to have a couple of specific extensions, the VTX and EPT extensions for this to run on. So this is a subset, it's not gonna work on AMD chips, for example. The Hyper-V guest virtual machine that is gonna nest has to have a Hyper-V configuration of 8.0 or higher. If you look in Hyper-V Manager, you get different editions, different configuration versions, 6.2, 7.0, 8.0, it has to be the latest. If it's not the latest, you can right-click the VM and you can upgrade it to the latest. So it has to be 8.0, either natively or an upgraded configuration. So I'm not talking about the machine, I'm talking about the VM properties, the VM configuration file itself. Once we have that, we install a virtual machine. So again, it can be any of the three that we've talked about, server core, server GUI, nano. We have to set the processor of the virtual machine to allow us to do this with set VM processor. And we go ahead, start up the VM, and then just go ahead and install Hyper-V inside the VM like you would any other machine.
The VM guest, I believe, can also be Windows 10 Anniversary Edition. So it's not limited to Server 2016. I believe it can be Anniversary Edition.
It is,
Windows
yeah,
10
we have
well.
It on slide two. Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's there. So that's pretty cool. One thing you do need to be aware of with that is things like the settings for VMs. And we'll talk about the networks to do with making that happen as well in a short while. But also be familiar with more generic stuff around Hyper-V. Much of this hasn't changed that much. If you're used to this on 2012, I'll keep this brief. But know about things like generation one, generation two, how to turn on metering, resource metering, so you can capture stats on how much CPU and disk and memory is being consumed by each VM. If you're interested in chargeback and you want to know for this department how much compute time has that department consumed by their virtual machines, then we have to turn on resource metering in PowerShell to get that and then enumerate that back also with PowerShell as well. So we've got a screenshot here of some of the settings. I'm not going to walk through them all here with you, but make sure that you have. Make sure you understand. Many of these settings have expansion plus arrows next to it, which folks often don't see. So things like the processor, you can expand that. The network, you can expand that. There are deeper settings in there, things like NUMA spanning. Go away, fly. NUMA spanning, you can turn that on and off. Walk through those things. Make sure you understand them all. Some of these often get missed, okay? Generation 1, Generation 2 virtual machines. Nothing new here since 2012, so again, I'll keep this brief, but understand the differences. I've laid out a screenshot of each one so you can see what hardware differences you get between each one. But broadly speaking, Generation 2 is designed for newer operating systems. We have native support for Pixie Boot on the emulated network card. We have support for UEFI by firmware here. So you can also use things like Secure Boot for the guest operating system in there as well, if that operating system supports it. So pretty easy to kind of walk through and set up two different kinds of VMs and walk through side by side like I've done to see what you get different. So things like IDE controllers are unique to Gen 1. So it's kind of older versus newer operating system support, to put it in a nutshell. Hyper-V storage. So I want to spend a second on this because this is worth mentioning, I think. We can consume VHDs as well as VHDX files for Hyper-V virtual machines. We talked about those formats before. We also mentioned about shared virtual hard disks also. If you have a VHDX file that's on shared storage, you can actually map two or more virtual machines through to that and have them read-write to that same VHDX file at the same time. So great if you're doing guest-based clustering, for example, inside of VMs. We also have access for pass-through disks. I have a customer that runs backups on their host computer, and on the guest computer on a Hyper-V instance, and they actually map an external drive through as a pass-through disk. So they're giving exclusive access to that physical disk to the VM. So the host computer has it attached, but we can pass that through. So you get the complete raw performance of that disk presented to the VM. In terms of the different kinds of disks, when you're adding virtual hard disks, you've got some choices over fixed, dynamic, and differencing. There are some rules for the game here, but essentially if you're doing a production server, it should always be a fixed disk. That way it's gonna consume the full amount of space that you're dedicating to it from day one. If you're doing some testing, playing around, home lab, differencing disks are the way to go because that will reduce the total amount of storage you're using on day one and then grow that storage space as the file extends. Okay, so it's a very thin provisioning, I guess you could almost call that, for virtual hard disks. Yep. So I use that a lot for my test labs. Differencing disks we sometimes use if we're building chains. If I want to repeatedly deploy the same type of machine time and time again from a virtual hard disk, I can build a differencing disk. So I've got several things based on the same parent. So you have a parent-child relationship. Shared, we already talked about. I'm going to skip that one. Networking. Some changes here, guys. So networking is for Hyper-V includes things like knowing about switches, know about the network adapters as well. So I mentioned about the Hyper-V guest settings. Walk through that. There's a whole ton of settings on here. I think I have on the NIC. Here we go. That you can configure, such as bandwidth throttling. You've got bandwidth management on a network adapter. You've got support for things like VLANs. If you use VLANs on your physical network, you may want your VM to participate on that and send the same VLAN identifier through so it can talk on that VLAN. Okay. In terms of the switches, we've got four. Three of them are shown in the interface. There's a fourth one that's not shown that's new as well, which I have down the bottom here. So the first three are external, internal, and private. If you've seen Hyper-V before, they're not new. One allows you to connect machines to your wider network and to see the host. That's the external. The internal only allows you to talk VM to VM and VM to host. And finally, private is VM to VM only. So you can create isolation with that. Yes, sir?
Can you hot add NICs?
Can we hot add NICs? Yes. We can hot add NICs.
Is that new for 2016?
That is. No. We could do it in 2012 R2, I think.
We could do it in 2012 as well. Yeah, we can hot add NICs. A new type of switch that we have that's not actually bubbled up in the GUI here is a NAT switch. Okay, so we do that through PowerShell only at this time. New-VM switch, name, whatever you want to call it. But the switch type is NAT. Okay, and that's going to be useful a little bit later. Watch this space. Okay. I like to tease. All right, next up, NIC teaming. Teaming's been around for a while. One of the things we do have now is what's a feature called switch embedded teaming. This is kind of a new, well, leveraging new technologies essentially, using things like RDMA, VMQ to give you better performance here so that your NIC teams work at a much higher performance in effect. So you're able to leverage the assets on the physical network cards that you weren't able to before. So that was something we just couldn't take advantage of before. We could certainly NIC team in 2012. That's pretty cool. We can do that in guests or hosts, but we were never able to take advantage of those features. So that's something new here. It's kind of part of, it's just naturally sort of supported. Okay, NIC settings I've talked about, but I've just got this here for reference. I'd also point out things like MAC address spoofing. Sometimes that's useful. We've got an example of that coming up a little bit later too. Okay, so here's a question. Do you want to take this?
Sure. You plan to deploy a Hyper-V based, I don't know which one was yours. I have to open up a new one. You plan to deploy a Hyper-V based nested virtualization solution onto a number of servers. The nested servers need to access the internet. You have the following virtual machines available. You need to identify which servers from the following table can be used for this purpose. Which servers should you identify? 1 and 2, 2 and 3, 1 and 3, 3 and 4. And I'm not going to read the table, but it's up there.
So, single letter answer, guys. A, B, or A, B, C, or D? B? I think most people said B.
Wait, was that B or D?
D is Bravo.
B for Bravo, mostly, I think people say. Let's see. Oh.
Oh, we don't have an animation.
Where's the animation? Come on. That was my fault. So the answer is 3 and 4.
3 and 4 is D, but we're just talking about MAC address spoofing. If you want your VM to be able to access the internet, it has to be able to get there somehow, either through a NAT table or through MAC address spoofing.
Yeah, so this is a new feature. We put this in because we thought you would not get the right answer, because we wanted to teach you something along the way here too. So the version we talked about has to be 8.0. We talked about that already. But yeah, the network configuration, if you want your nested VM right at the top of that stack there to be able to go through your physical machine, then it's got to be able to pass through two layers of networking. One way to do that is MAC address spoofing. The other way to do that is through a NAT switch that we talked about a few slides ago. So something new. Didn't expect you guys to know that, but...
But we do have the link there for more information on that as well. It's on MSDN.
Yep.
Why doesn't two work?
Because you would only pass the packets up through one layer of the switching. It wouldn't pass it up through two layers of the switching out beyond the host.
Right.
You'd get it from the guest, the top-level guest to the middle-level guest, but you wouldn't get it from the middle-level guest down below. It's two networks it has to pass through. Okay? Read the thing. Okay. We haven't got time. So quick summary here, top tips. Know the difference between the switch types. We've called out the fact that there are four, there are three on the picture. There's the NAT switch. Obviously, you guys need to learn on that. Know about some of the features you get on NICs, SRIOV, virtual machine queue, RDMA support, that kind of stuff. Know also really those advanced NIC settings. This is one of those areas where people just don't understand that you have to press plus to get all those extra things up we talked about. And also how to implement teaming, both on hosts and within guest machines. Those are some of our top tips. What's next? Containers. Now, containers is a new feature. Hands up who's played with containers before in Windows Server. Ooh, about 5%, 10% tops. Okay, so it's a new feature. It isn't a huge area on the exam.
I think it was 5% of the exam.
So
what that means is, let's say the exam bank has 300 questions. 5% of those will be on containers, and you'll get a smaller percent. There's only like 75 questions on the exam, whatever it is, so a quarter of that. So you need to know containers, but there's other things to deep dive.
You need to know everything, but what we're saying is, you know, study wisely, because it's a new thing. You'd be tempted to say, I'm going to spend weeks and weeks and weeks learning this thing and not everything else. And then yeah, you might get a fantastic 100% bar in the containers area on the test, but it's unfortunately not going to get you a pass because it's only 5 or 10% of the overall exam. That said, let's talk about it. So containers, we do need to know about how to deploy containers. It's a new piece of technology. We're going to try and expand on that as we go through. So what is a container? This is our traditional kind of stack here. We have on a regular machine, so you'd have your hardware at the bottom, your operating system in the middle, and your applications at the top. So that's pretty standard. What we have now, though, is also hardware virtualization, so running VMs on top of that hardware. That's all stuff that we've been used to, nothing new here. But where does containers come in? Containers allows you to effectively bubble it up. So you can have individualized kernels available for your applications to run in to create some isolation here. I say some isolation because Windows containers is one way of doing things to create these little compute containers. But also, there's a second way of doing this as well, which is Hyper-V containers as well, which allows you to have a different kernel exposed effectively to each of the containers. So it's a similar thing, but you're using Hyper-V technologies as well as containers to get that done. So it seems like at first glance a bit of a subtle difference, but there's pros and cons to each one. One's more about performance, one's more about isolation. Okay.
Yep. Go ahead, question.
Where does App-V fit into that? It doesn't. So you could be running it inside of a VM. You could be running it inside of as a guest workload, I guess. But this is not an App-V diagram as such.
Yeah, so App-V runs in like a sandbox, if you will, but not in a container. They're kind of different. They're not related to each other.
Yeah, so this is more for server-based applications rather than your typical kind of client application that you're describing. But conceptually, you're kind of thinking the right way.
Right.
It's similar to that. But this is more for server workloads rather than client applications. But conceptually, you're not far off with it.
There was a question in the back.
The Hyper-V container, does that run on a standard Hyper-V host, or is that a separate role that you can install?
The question is, does Hyper-V containers run on a Hyper-V host? It requires Hyper-V technologies on the computer that's running that.
Is it separate?
It requires multiple components to be installed. So you're going to require some Hyper-V components to be installed, and you're going to require the containers support installing as well. They're kind of independent of one another, but you still need to add both. Okay. You should go and sit some container sessions this week because this is new technology, right? So installing support for this. So we briefly mentioned this. So installing the Windows container support. Also, containers might need things like network support too. And this is where things like VM switches could come into play. You might want applications in your container to be able to reach a network. In which case, how do we map that through? This is actually quite similar to what we described with Hyper-V. Containers need things like IP addresses. Containers need configuration. So something you've got to get familiar with is how do we actually do that? And I've got a slide coming up in a second for that. But I just want to quickly mention about Docker support as well. This is supported on Windows Server. You do have to download some binaries for this, though. You actually go to Docker and grab some of their files. They've kind of made it easy for you to do that because we've actually got some PowerShell that does it. But learn about Docker, learn about the Docker daemon and how to configure that so that you can provide support for Docker applications. A lot of the documentation you need for this is not going to be on the Microsoft site. It's actually going to be on the Docker website. So don't just be looking on TechNet. Certainly read that. But also you want to look on Docker as well, on Docker's site. We've got too much on here to talk about. But look up applications like Dockerd. You need to get familiar with that. Okay, Dockerd is just a one-time thing that adds Docker as a service. It's not native to Windows, so we have to add it in there to get the container support for Docker on our systems. So that's just a case of run Dockerd once. But there's also, you know, a few other bits and pieces which we've got, I think, coming up. Have we got it on the file? No, we don't have it on here. Okay. I was tempted, but the file was too big. Okay, so know about managing them. We talked a little bit about networking. The Docker file, oh yeah, it is mentioned here. So understand the Docker file is a Docker configuration file which will allow you to set things like IP addresses and so forth for the Docker containers. So you've got to know about docker.exe, which is the engine. You've got to know about docker.d.exe to register that as a service on your system. It's a little bit kind of clunky, but it does require a bit of reading. So a couple of top tips to manage. Understand about network support you need to provide. Is it going to be NATed? Are you going to need to do IP addresses on those containers to allow those to network? Okay, but do read up more. This is a fairly new piece of technology. Hardly anyone here in this room has used it so far. So play with it, sure, but don't spend too much time on it.
For the exam. For work.
Yeah, for what it's worth. You know, for 5 to 10%, don't go sweating too much. Okay, quick question here then. Let's see if you can get this one.
Hey, your company is developing an application named App One that will run on Server 2016. App One is very resource intensive. You plan to deploy App One onto a Windows Server 2016 server. You need to ensure that App One does not interfere with other applications running on the same server. How should you deploy it? Create a Gen 2 VM, create a Nano Server instance, create a Windows Server container, and create a Hyper-V container.
Okay, mostly C's, a couple of D's. It is D. So D is correct because, partly because of the resource intensity of it, but also isolation. If you want the ultimate for isolation, a Hyper-V container gives you that. Think back to the diagrams you saw with the individual kernels. Okay. So top tips, find out more. This is new tech. Find out more, download things like Docker, experiment with it. You've got native support for Windows Server containers. You've got native support for Hyper-V containers, inbox. Docker support you download and add separately. Play with that. Learn that. Keep up to date. Some of this is deliberately not Microsoft tech. They've, you know, allowed you to bring Docker here from things like Azure, where you can use it already, into your on-prem systems, which I think is quite nice. So find out about that. Find out about containerization, really, in general. And also, understand when it's best to create a VM. When is it best to use a physical machine? When is it best to use a Nano? Or when is it best to use a container? That's something that's going to be, you know, you need to do some reading. Yes, chap in the check shirt.
So, what's important is about 5 to 10%.
Okay, so for this exam, it's 5 to 10%. What would it be for the upgrade MCSA exam? Not sure, haven't seen that.
So, what they do, though, for those upgrade exams, and again, we haven't seen this specific one, but in the MCSA exam upgrades past, they take the actual exams that you need. Like, you can take the 4 individual exams, or you can take that one upgrade. They take a subset of questions, actual questions from each one. So it still won't be more than 5%, because that's all that there is in that portion of the exam. So with most upgrade exams, again, we haven't seen this one, but I have to assume it goes with the way the rest of them go. You take one portion of the exam, grade it. Take one portion of the exam, grade it. You can't go back to the first one once you've gotten through that. So it's basically taking a subset of each of the exams all at once.
That's in general. We haven't seen this one.
Right. So. But again, we haven't seen this one yet, so we can't say for sure.
Okay, so next few sections, we're going to go through pretty quick. High availability. So I'm going to try and focus on things that are mostly new or things that are likely to catch people out here. So high availability, we have tons and tons of options. We could spend a whole week on this. But we're going to talk about things like when we use different services, we've got failover clustering, we've got network load balancing. When would you use each thing? Where do they also combine together? So for some solutions, you might need some storage replication. You might also want some failover clustering. You know, some of these actually come together to provide a solution. So there are many pieces to this. We're going to try and uncover a few of these, starting with Hyper-V. So with Hyper-V, we can do host-based clusters. You can run highly available virtual machines. You build the cluster at the host level. The virtual machine itself, regardless of workload, is highly available. That can sustain a server failure. You've also got guest-based clusters, so we can install things like workloads like SQL or Exchange and have those running inside of our guests, where we tend to prefer to have our high availability working, not at the host level. We can also perform things like live migrations. We can move virtual machines between hosts without any downtime.
Virtually no downtime. It's in the milliseconds, so it's virtually no downtime. There's a question in the back.
Does it require, guest-based clusters? Guest-based clusters require fiber channel. Oh, I see what you're saying. They don't necessarily, actually. It depends. Some guest-based clusters require zero shared storage. But if you are using some shared storage, it may be fiber channel, it may be iSCSI. We've got, in terms of Hyper-V, we've got a fiber channel SAN that you can present so that you can access that physical shared storage through to the VM. But actually, it depends on the workload. Some workloads require zero shared storage and just use local storage. So it may require it. All right, failover clustering. I'm going to hop through this somewhat quickly because most of this is similar or same as 2012. But basically, a cluster is a unit of workload for any application potentially to use. I say potentially because not all applications are clusterable. You need to look at that. You know, you just can't cluster something like a domain controller, right? That's not ever going to be clusterable. But other workloads, such as file server, could be, and they're natively supported. So you do need to know about that. You need to know also about how to build clusters, validate clusters, add storage, add other resources, and also experiment with things like failover as well. One thing that is new for 2012 is rolling upgrades, the ability to keep workloads running and to minimize downtime even further than we had before. So you can actually perform what we call a rolling upgrade with inside the cluster. Okay, I'm going to skip through this pretty quick because running out of time. Yeah, so the software-defined data center, this is something you've got more and more of these days, and we've talked about adding to that with storage replicas as well. So you don't really need that much, well, you need hardware, but you don't need as much reliance on specialized hardware to do this kind of stuff. So it's much more within reach of smaller customers now. Okay, I'm going to zip through this stuff because that's not changed. Oh, too much building.
And again, you are getting these slides as well.
Yeah, we are.
Did he really add all that?
I thought that was one picture.
So did I.
Click. Okay. We're going to move on. Okay, so yeah, we talked about storage. So lots of options for shared storage if you need it. And most applications do, but some don't. So you can provide iSCSI, you can provide Fibre Channel. We talked about the shared hard disks as well. Okay, so know about building the cluster, whether it's PowerShell, whether it's the cluster manager, either are good. Okay, like we say, possibly add to that the storage replica. And this is kind of a really nice piece of the jigsaw puzzle, which we were basically missing before through software, that many of you plugged that hole with hardware solutions. So we can add that in now. I really love that. And to really augment that, you have this new feature called Storage Spaces Direct. This ability to consume storage that's essentially local on each compute unit, but to aggregate that and pool that. So, you know, we talked about storage spaces, storage pools earlier. That's typically per server. What we're now mentioning is that actually you can combine local JBOD storage that's available on each box and present that as one shared pool of disks, okay, without any kind of fancy networking or any kind of fancy disk enclosures. So that's something to look into, guys. That's all new. Okay, we call it Storage Spaces Direct. There's a couple of different ways of using that. One's called the Hyper-V Converged Stack. There's a couple of different ways. So understand about managing clusters, how to make sure that they keep working, what happens if something fails, how do I repair it, how do I evict nodes from a cluster. All this kind of life cycle of a cluster is something you need to know about, not just building it, but managing it day to day too.
And make sure you understand, it was one of the slides that we did zip through because it hasn't changed, but know the difference between like active-active, active-passive, and all that stuff with clustering as well. Mm-hmm. Again, it's not changed, so it's if you don't know clustering at all, it hasn't changed in the last several operating systems.
Okay, so we talked about virtual machine movements. I talked about live migrations before. Also know about quick migrations, storage migrations, imports, exports. These are all different ways of making sure that you can get a virtual machine running from one host to another. And there's several different ways of doing it, and it's about choices. Some minimize downtime, some minimize actual time, okay? But give you downtime, if that makes sense. So talk to us at the end if you want to know more about this.
It
kind of summarizes it here quite nice. So quick migrations, put virtual machines into a safe state, move them along, and then resume them from a same saved state. But that is going to incur downtime.
But it is
the quickest way to get it done.
It is, but make sure the application that's running in the VM supports that as well, because not all application vendors wrote that into their application. So it's the quickest way, causes some downtime, but the application has to support it as well.
But both of these are native in 2016. You don't need anything special, just a network to connect the two boxes together.
Okay.
Could they ask any questions about replica and failover? Absolutely. Yep, that's all part of the stack.
Was the question, did they ask any? Could they?
They could.
Yeah,
they absolutely could, because that's all part of it. We don't have it on the slides here, but the Hyper-V replica, sure, that's in scope. Network load balancing, a service that's been around for a long time, hasn't really changed that much, but know it, because it's a good optional way of giving high availability for certain applications, web applications predominantly. So certainly know how to build this out, when it's used, when it's not used. We can have up to 32 nodes in an NLB cluster here. So when we say cluster here, please don't get that confused with failover cluster. I know it's the same word, but there's NLB clusters and there's failover clusters. This has nothing to do with failover clusters. What I would say is look at the applications. Are they stateful to do this against? If you've got a web application, if it's not stateful, can we still use it? Possibly. You need to look at that first of all to see if it's even viable. You've also got to consider what we call session state. Mostly if you're running web applications on IIS, they're in process session state. In other words, if you hit box number one, that's going to remember your session. But if you then get redirected to box number two, it's not going to know about you. So you might want to keep that session state data off server in a database to augment this NLB high availability that you're doing. It's not just about adding NLB. You've got to look at the whole package here. In terms of the exam, know about how to build NLB, how to put build up port rules, affinity settings, drain stops. We're running out of time, aren't we? So we've got to move on. All right, we're going to skip this, I think, for time.
Yeah, we are. So we actually have, I think, about 3 minutes left.
Yeah.
So I'm going to probably just stay here. So WSUS, WSUS groups are a way of patching your servers, updating your OSs, updating your drivers on your servers, on your desktops. You know, it's all about patch management, basically. And this is not a lot changed. One of the new changes in WSUS is that a computer can be a member of multiple groups. And that's something that's new. So again, it downloads, distributes, updates clients. It can be installed as a single server, like multiple single servers where they just go up to Microsoft, get them, and then send them out to the clients. In this case, a client could be a server, right, at the WSUS client, configured through group policy or local policy. You can have it set up in a hierarchy where the client with a WSUS server, the primary one goes out to Microsoft, downloads the patches, sends them to secondary ones via branch offices and whatnot. You can also have a disconnected WSUS server where you put the patches on a USB drive and actually walk it over to the clients. Just some administration. You can administer through PowerShell commandlets, and we have a table of the PowerShell commandlets here. Again, I'm not going to read them to you. And, of course, through the WSUS admin console. This exam, to my knowledge, assumes you're not integrating SCCM or Config Manager with WSUS. They're using WSUS on its own.
Yeah.
So don't look for any SCCM-type questions, Config Manager questions.
What's the version number of the new one? I can't remember.
I think it's 4.0. 3.0 is probably 4 years old now, anyway. But I think it's,
substantially not different to 2012, basically. But also, they've got support now for things like Windows 10 features and quality updates.
Right. The whole servicing model. Also, remember, Windows Defender can be integrated with, 90 seconds left. With. So Windows Defender and definition updates can be integrated with WSUS. You just need to add those categories to make sure that they are being pulled down when WSUS syncs its catalog. We also talk about Windows Server Backup. And I'm going to skip over this and just monitoring your servers through Performance Monitor, Resource Monitor, Task Manager. Did I miss? Data Collector Sets, which is part of Performance Monitor to let you know exactly what's being collected. Event Traces. Oh, Traces is spelled wrong there. Event Traces, System Configuration Information, scheduling your data collecting as well.
So a lot of the old favorite tools are still there, still work the same way.
Yep. And we talked about like NanoServer might be missing some of them, but we can remotely manage, monitor through the other tools. We talked about Resource Monitor. We can open that up right from our Task Manager, or we can type in Resource Monitor and open it up. And again, you can get real-time information here. One thing you do want to know is, when's it better for me to use Resource Monitor versus Task Manager versus Performance Monitor for monitoring the performance? I can see processor stuff on all of them, but I can end a task with Task Manager. I can get historical data with Performance Monitor. So the different scenarios will require different tools. So, why not? You plan to deploy a new website to your web server tomorrow. You plan to monitor the amount of requests to the website during the first hour of it going into production. You need to ensure that you can discuss the results in a meeting at the end of the day. How should you collect the information? Load settings into Resource Monitor. Use Performance Monitor to create a report. Use Performance Monitor to start System Data Collector Set. Or use Performance Monitor to create a user-defined data collector set. All right, so
bit of a blend.
The room knows its performance monitor. They're just not sure if it's a report view, or system data collector set, or user defined data collector set, and it's user defined data collector set.
It's user defined because we want to get some IIS stats, which are non standard. The system one would grab a lot of stuff like CPU, memory, but it wouldn't get IIS stats. All right, cool.
So just a couple last tips. Understand server patching from the admin console, the PowerShell commands in that table from the other slide. Again, know with Hyper-V backing up at the host level, which backs up everything, or at the guest level and in-guest backup, and know all the different tools. Can I close out?
All right, cool. So we've covered then all the different areas. Again, please look through wisely when you're studying that you spend the right time in the right area. Thank you very much for your time. We're here to ask questions of. But thank you for your time being here. And don't forget, do the evaluations, win prizes, and be respected. Thank you very much for your time, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.